Welcome, everybody. This is the fifth and final lecture in the Mises Academy online class, Adventures in Energy Economics. Today is July 30th, 2013. And this last lecture, I'm just calling broadly the policy debate. And it's sort of a catch-all things that I've, let me put it this way, because up till now, we've been focusing on the pure theory. Largely, that we've taken the Pigouvian arguments and other arguments for government intervention in the energy markets, and we've sort of taken them on their own terms, and then even brought in some public choice and some specifically Austrian objections to that sort of thing. But I've, in addition to being an academic and reading the books and writing academic articles and things like that on this subject, I've also been actively engaged in what you could call the policy debate, and I've. Yeah, as you know, I work for the Institute for Energy Research. I'm their senior economist, and I've testified before Congress. And a lot of what IER, Institute for Energy Research, a lot of what they do is try to present the free market perspective in the policy debates as opposed to academia. And, you know, there's different viewpoints as to whether that's more effective or not. And I'm sympathetic to both sides in that particular debate, and I actually have a foot in both camps that I try to publish stuff on pure theory and, you know, real esoteric highbrow stuff that only professors read. But on the other hand, I also, have done something as hands-on as participate in a bus tour. Now that's actually not in the slides, though. I wasn't going to officially cover that, but I'm just giving an idea that it was, when was it? Maybe a year and a half ago. It was part of a different group. It wasn't IER, it was a different sister organization, and they sponsored a bus tour. And so that they hired some guy who, his job, he's an entrepreneur, he owned a big bus and rents it out for various events. And so for this event, you know, we got a bunch of our people who were, you know, knew how to take video footage and were versed in energy issues from a free market perspective, talking about, you know, the Keystone pipeline and things like that that were pretty hot button at the time, fracking, natural gas exploration, things like that. And this bus just went on a tour across the country. And so some of the experts, and I use that term with all due humility, like me and then other people either with PhDs or who's had a lot of experience on the academic side of things, we would go meet the bus somewhere. So it wasn't like we were a band and we were all in the bus on day one and just literally went around the whole country. A lot like what I did, for example, with my schedule permitting, I said, okay, you know, this week here, I can go meet the bus in Michigan because, you know, I had taught at Hillsdale. So the thinking was, well, I might know some people up there. Maybe we could get up a crowd. So the bus was making stops at places in Michigan. And so what did I do? Did I fly? I think what I did is I flew to Michigan because I live in Nashville. So I flew to Michigan, then rented a car, and then I went and met the bus. And then, you know, we did an event at some city, and it was like, and these, when you say, what do you mean these events? It was stuff like we'd go to a restaurant and 30 people would show up and, you know, they got a free meal, and they just, the point of it was like to talk about energy issues and to explain to them the stuff that would affect their individual, you know, households because of various things. So it was always a friendly crowd. It was, you know, how did these people even know about it? Well, they must have been on a mailing list or, you know, subscribed to some website or whatever. But there was some way that they were part of this, and that was how they partly determined where the bus would stop. We didn't want to stop somewhere and have nobody show up. And so that was the, you know, we had affiliated groups who had sort of grassroots efforts. And so, you know, we would have them try to build a little crowd for us, and then the bus would pull up and we'd get out and, you know, do our thing and then get back on the bus, or I actually was driving my rental car and following the bus around. So that was the, you know, example of what I'm talking about. That's clearly the antithesis of writing a peer-reviewed journal article. But the point was, you know, you couldn't just have someone show up who said, hey, you know, I don't like the government. You had to have somebody who kind of knows the issues. And so that was a particular example. So, but with this last lecture, I don't want this to be academic. I just kind of want to tell stories that are either entertaining or illustrate the actual nature of how government behaves in the real world. So let me just give you one quick thing. This isn't about government, but this somebody was a wise guy. So this part of what we were doing is every time we'd make one of these stops at one of these places, let me tell you two quick little anecdotes before we get into more serious stuff. So one of the stops was at a college campus in the local chapter of, and I don't even remember what the organization was. You know, so it wasn't our group. It was like some group that just cared about small government. You know, it was a broader thing. It wasn't just about energy issues, but our people had contacted their people and said, hey, do you have anything near Ann Arbor? We're coming through. And I think it might have been at Ann Arbor, but I might be getting mixed up. We made a bunch of stops right in a row all in that area, in Michigan. So in any event, one of the stops we were supposed to go talk to, I'm making this up, I don't remember, it might have been like the College Republicans, let's say, but it wasn't the College Republicans, it was some other group that maybe would have talked to them and said, hey, do your members want to show up at this thing? So anyway, we show up at this deal, you know, and we're all ready to talk about energy issues, and we brought five pizzas because you figure this is the way to get college kids to show up or something. We get in this classroom, and it's a Saturday, and nobody shows up. Like, literally nobody shows up except, like, two people who were in the College Republicans, you know, because they cared about energy issues. And so we're all sitting there with five pizzas, and there's, like, four of us. And, you know, I just said to the organizer, I said, I'm not going to give a speech to two poor kids that are just sitting there on a Saturday morning. There's no way I can do it. So instead of doing the official deal, we sort of like arranged the chairs in a circle and sort of just talked about stuff. And, hey, what are you guys doing? Okay, yeah, what are you going to do? You're going to go to grad school, blah, 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 you know, that kind of deal. And then we had all these pizzas sitting here, and there was some I was in the Greek system. I don't know if they were doing pickup or rushing or whatever the heck they were doing, but they were doing some kind of official sorority event. And so the organized, like, this young woman who was, like, the liaison, I think she kind of felt embarrassed that people didn't show up to this deal. And, you know, we went out of the way with the bus to stop at this college campus, and then nobody's there to see our deal. And so she goes, well, hang on, let me see. So she goes and talks to the sorority. So then all of these sorority girls show up to get the pizza. And the organizer tells us, how about we make them sit here and listen to the speech first before they get the pizza? And we were just like, no, there's no way. I mean, can you imagine having a bunch of poor college sorority girls show up thinking they're getting a free pizza, and then they got to see this bald guy give a lecture on fracking? And I just said, no, absolutely not. Just give them the pizza, and we don't need to cajole them into listening to this. But anyway, so that's some of the stuff that happens, you know, hit or miss. At other places, though, it was fine. Like, it was the older crowd turned out. So we went to some diner at some other hole-in-the-wall place in Michigan. And it was like we got there at the time for, like, the senior citizens early bird special. And so that's why the restaurant was fine with it, because we want them to be interfering with their rush hour. And we got a big crowd. But it was all, like, well, not all, but it was mostly people that were retired. And they had a lot of free time, and this particular group was obviously very conservative and didn't like what the Obama administration was doing. So they came out partly, again, because I think the meal was probably free for them. And so anyway, so we were able to get the old people to turn out, but the college kids on a Saturday morning, even though they had committed to showing up to this deal, probably went out the night before and got drunk, and then at 8:30 in the morning on Saturday, realized, you know, I really don't care that much about fracking. Okay, so let's jump into this. All right, first, let me give you some background before I talk about specifically energy issues. So here, it's partly what I'm doing is letting you know my own views on the government have changed over the years. Now, obviously, I don't mean in the academic sense. Even when I was in high school, I was a Misesian. I had read Human Action as a senior in high school. I didn't understand all of it, but I knew enough to say, holy cow, this is great. I want to be an Austrian economist when I grow up. And so that's why I went to Hillsdale, because that's where Mises' library was. Became an economics major and then went on to NYU and so on. I knew that as of, at the latest, my senior year in high school and probably earlier than that. But even, and then of course I was a self-described libertarian. But what I'm saying is, it's one thing to have views about what the proper role of government, if any, are, and versus your understanding of what motivates actual politicians and bureaucrats and special interest groups and lobbyists and that sort of thing, and understanding how is it that certain issues turn out. You know, how does the actual day-to-day workings of political power in D.C. and elsewhere, how does that actually play out? And so my views on that have evolved a lot since my senior year in high school. So let me just give you a little bit of that background. Not that it means I'm right. I'm still pretty young, and I'm sure in another 30 years, my perspective will have changed even more. But certainly I've just heard some stories and seen some stuff with my own eyes that changed my view of things. And so maybe I'll allow some of you to accelerate your own accumulation of wisdom by sharing some of my experiences. Okay, so first, let me give some wisdom from one of my college economics professors, Gary Wolfram. So he was at Hillsdale, still is actually. So it's kind of neat. I was there as a student. He was there. He was one of my favorite professors. Then I went back to teach at Hillsdale, and he was kind of like my immediate boss. So that was kind of neat. And now we're still in touch. But anyway, so he was just, in terms of making economics or making economists seem cool, as opposed to seeming like number crunching nerds, this guy Gary Wolfram was like the epitome of that. All right, that, you know, because I was clearly a nerd growing up. I was, you know, valedictorian in eighth grade and then senior year in high school. And as you can imagine, when kids wanted to think of something to say to make fun of me, they would, you know, be, oh, I was Bob the Brain, that kind of thing. So I kind of went into Hillsdale trying to hide that stuff and being a little bit timid about telling people what I was interested in and so forth. But Gary Wolfram really like just made it look like, no, economists could be cool. And specifically what it was is he was just incredibly, I mean, it's true he was incredibly intelligent, but beyond that, it seemed like, you know, he gave the air when he would give lectures and just, you know, talk to people about stuff. You really got the sense that Gary Wolfram understood how the government worked, you know, that he knew what was going on. And so just to give you two quick anecdotes. So one time he was giving a lecture on what's called public choice theory, and the specific issue was the school lunch program. And he was speaking from firsthand experience because he had been an advisor to and conceivably the chief economist for, but I'm not sure about that, but for sure he was an economic advisor to the Republican governor of Michigan, John Engler, you know, or he had been. Like at this point, I think, I can't remember if Engler was still governor when I was a student, but in any event, Wolfram, you know, had extensive experience with state level politics, talking about that, you know, working on issues at the state level. And he understood politics in that realm. And so he was saying, you know, one of the things is the politicians would have these hearings on the school lunch program. And so they'd hear testimony from various people offering their opinions on, you know, gee, what constitutes a nutritional lunch and da 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 da, and you know, should we just rely on families to feed their kids before they send them off to school, or is that something that, and of course they're talking about government schools, also known as public schools. And so Wolfram was, you know, he was just saying that, you know, and I'm going to do my horrible Gary Wolfram impression, but he just had this real laid back, like everything was amusing to him. That was the thing. He was not angry at the way politics worked. It just amused him. And in particular, how what happened behind closed doors in the real world was so much different from the show that the politicians put on for the public and that the average voter and citizen believed. Like, so that's what amused him. Like I said, and since he would convey that, if you're a young college kid, this guy seems awesome. Because college kids love, or, you know, kids in general love that kind of stuff when they know adults lie to them all the time. And I don't even mean maliciously, but they, little kids know that adults don't tell them the full truth. You know, it's kind of stuff like, well, you know, when you're older, we'll tell you more about that. And so this guy Wolfram comes along and purports to be telling them, this is how things really behave. Let me tell you, don't believe what you've learned in your civics class. And so that's why it was instantly exciting to hear this guy talk. But anyway, like the school lunch program, you can say, no, I mean, come on, man. We think the school lunch program is about, you know, feeding inner city minority kids. What do you think shows up to these lunch meetings, man? Come on. It's not like the poor black mothers. No, man, it's the food vendors. Come on. Right. And he wasn't, in case you don't understand the context, because he was, you know, Detroit would be a big area in Michigan politics for this kind of thing. And so that would be a huge market. So if somebody, you know, if we're talking about funding for poorer children who might not be able to get a bring a good lunch from home, and they might be hungry during the school day because their mom didn't send them with food because, you know, they can't afford it or whatever. They just come from a broken family. So that's what he's saying. The way the politics came down in this, there was a racial aspect to it, that it seemed like, you know, if you were for funding, it was because you really were concerned about the African-American community and wanted to make sure that they didn't get left behind with inadequate educational opportunities. You know, so that's why he was saying the thing about, you know, who shows up at this meeting. He's saying it's not poor black mothers. He was saying it's all food vendors. Okay, so you get what I'm saying there? That his point was, there's going to be a lot of money at stake here. If the government decides to fund these school lunch programs, there's millions of dollars every year that are going to now flow into the hands of food vendors who get picked to be the ones supplying the free lunches to the kids who qualify for it. So, of course, the vendors are going to be very interested in convincing the public that, yes, this is a serious issue. And in any decent society, of course, the government would pay so that the kids going to public schools aren't starving to get the death during algebra. And how can they be expected to retain information and to, you know, reap the full benefits of this government provided schooling if they're sitting there and their stomach's growling, right? Because they come from an unfortunate family situation. And so, of course, in addition to providing them with textbooks and so forth, we're going to provide them with school lunches, duh. And, you know, and this, the jockeying behind the scenes for who's going to get those contracts and all that stuff. And so, you know, Wolfram's point was, they can't go out in front of the cameras and say, we're going to go ahead and fund this program because these food vendors contributed to my campaign and I'm getting paid a bunch of money. And so that's why this is my issue now. Or, you know, certain groups in this area who are part of my constituency are going to benefit from this. And so I want to cater to them. No one's going to say that. They're going to have to couch everything in terms of abstract issues, right? And so the opponents of it, you know, if there's some other vendor perhaps that right now is supplying the cafeteria with stuff that's paid, that's the cafeteria charges for it. I mean, I'm making these details up to give you an example of what I mean. Suppose there's one company that provides the French fries to the cafeteria. When the kids go in there with their own money, then they go buy the French fries. But maybe if the free school lunch program goes through, well, you can't give kids French fries because that's not healthy. Maybe you got to give them, you know, vegetables and something else and chicken. And so it might be different companies that stand to benefit from that switch. And so you could see there could be some other company that's against the free school lunches, not because they care about taxpayer money, but because it will affect their bottom line. And so, but they can't come out and say that. So they would have to go find experts to go testify because, you know, oh, well, this would worsen the deficit, or, you know, that kind of thing. So anyway, that was just one particular thing that he brought up that, for whatever reason, that's stuck with me, and I can still do my horrible Gary Wolfram impression to this day talking about that. Another example was with minimum wage laws. And just making sure you guys are all right, checking the chat box there. Another example is with minimum wage laws. So here, like I say, it's one thing to know intellectually that minimum wage laws cause unemployment. I had known that since reading Henry Hazlitt, right? He talks about that in Economics in One Lesson. So I had known that probably since I was a sophomore in high school at the latest, that a minimum wage law doesn't actually help poor people. It actually hurts poor people. But I thought our job is free market economists or people who know about free market economics was to write letters to the editor and get the word out because, oh my gosh, these idiots in Washington haven't even read Henry Hazlitt. They actually think, like Senator Ted Kennedy, this is what I thought, actually thinks that by passing minimum wage laws, they're helping unskilled workers. And man, if only somebody would explain to them, you know, would draw them a supply and demand curve for unskilled labor, they would see the mistake. Man, we got to go educate these people. That, I mean, as I'm telling you this now, I can't believe how naive that was, but that's what I thought until I took this course with Gary Wolfman on public choice economics. And so I don't remember how it came up, but we were in the hall, and I was, you know, it wasn't part of the class. I was just arguing with them. And I said something like, wait a minute. I mean, are you saying, I kind of just thought all the senators and, you know, would, because I think they must have recently raised the minimum wage. That's probably why we were talking about it. And I said something like, you know, well, isn't it just that those senators falsely believe that they're helping poor people? And he literally laughed in my face, not to be a jerk, but he was, you know, like it's the kind of thing where if he'd been drinking water, he probably would have went and spit it all out. And he just went, no, they don't think that. He goes, all right, well, maybe one of them does or something. But no, man, no. They vote for the minimum wage because it helps the unions, man. Come on. Right? And so let's unpack what he's saying. Think about it. Who benefits when the minimum wage gets raised in reality? Like the story is, the way they sell it to the public is that it's it helps the people earning the minimum wage, that they get paid more money. Duh. But of course, you know, it's not obvious. Yeah, if you retain your job, then you're better off. Arguably, there's actually situations where you can imagine you wouldn't be worse off because maybe the employer takes away, you know, your breaks, and maybe when you go to the break room, there's not a nice TV, and there's other stuff that's not there anymore because the employer's cutting back because he's got to pay you higher wages. So it's actually not clear that even the people who retain their job are better off. But for sure, the people who are now involuntarily unemployed, they clearly lose from minimum wage law. But who benefits? Wolfram was saying high-skilled laborer does, right? Because if you've got like union labor where they charge a lot per hour, but actually they're pretty well trained and they have certain standards of professionalism so that, you know, if you have a contract to be done, you know, you got a building that you want to build, and you can bring in the union labor and, you know, contractors and whatever who are all unionized, and they're going to do a decent job for you. It's just they're going to charge you a lot. So instead of that, you have the option of bringing in non-union workers, and they'll charge, you know, and so how can they compete? You know, especially like if they're undocumented aliens and things like that, you know, that have snuck here and they're actually working illegally. They have not had the extensive training and experience in carpentry and other stuff that the union workers typically have had. So how do they compete? Well, because they charge a much lower price. And how does the contractor get away with that? Because he can, you know, drive down the street and have these guys jump into his car and pay him very little. All right. So how do you compete with that? Is that one way is you raise the minimum wage. Now, technically, even illegal aliens, they don't get paid the minimum wage. That's something else entirely. But the point is, in general, if one group of contractors are all unionized and other ones aren't, the way the non-union ones compete is through charging a lower price. And that becomes harder for them to do if the minimum wage is raised, because now they have to either break the law or raise their own prices. And so now they're not as competitive with the labor contractors, or sorry, the unionized contractors. Okay, so Wolfram's point was one of the biggest constituencies in favor of raising the minimum wage, and also historically in favor of outlawing child labor, were the labor unions. And that was because it helped their members. Because if you're, you know, a 30-year-old male with 10 years experience in carpentry, you're going to charge a lot more than some 15-year-old kid. And so the way the kid competes with you is he charges less. Otherwise, you know, other things equal, of course someone's going to hire the carpenter that's a strong man who's got decade of experience versus some scrawny teenage kid. And so one way to ensure that outcome is to make it illegal for the scrawny teenage kid to really undercut the other guy's wage by having a minimum wage. Or to say it's just illegal. Like if you're only 12, to just say, no, it's illegal. If you're a 12-year-old boy, you can't work at all on a construction site. That's just flat out illegal. And so historically, some of the biggest backers of laws prohibiting or severely regulating child labor were labor unions. And so Wolfram's point is that's not a coincidence. It's not that the members of labor unions were more concerned about poor little children more than the general public was. It's that they stood to directly benefit financially from those regulations. And so given that labor unions are excellent in a democratic system for delivering votes to politicians who are considered friendly to big labor. And so, you know, the key senators and others who were big, you know, introducing the bills to raise the minimum wage and that kind of stuff, they probably in their elections would often win because labor unions would deliver the vote. They would tell their members, you know, and there's laws and stuff about how blatant it can be, but they would certainly let their members know Senator so-and-so is our friend. And on election day, not only should you vote for him, but you should make sure your friends do. And, you know, let everyone know that if you support the workers, you're going to vote for Senator so-and-so in the next election, not the other guy, not his opponent who hates workers. He's just a friend of management and big business and fat cat CEOs. But Senator so-and-so is a friend of the worker. In fact, he voted to raise the minimum wage. That's how much he loves work. He loves even the little guy. You see how that all fits together? When actually it's perverse when you realize what's really going on. Okay. A classic article here is in this realm is called Baptists and Bootleggers. So if you're interested in this stuff, go ahead and Google that. It's an actual peer-reviewed economics article. And the premise is, and now that phrase has just become a general concept in economics. So it's applicable in areas beyond the original historical meaning of it. So originally what it was talking about was alcohol prohibition. And the point was, you know, as economists, we can understand why prohibition. So this is in case I have foreign listeners here. In the United States, for a while, it was actually a constitutional amendment that made it illegal to produce and distribute alcohol. And so it was actually one of the few good things that FDR did is that when he first came into office, he started the ball rolling to get rid of this thing, to repeal it, and to then, you know, legalize alcohol again. So the movies you've seen with gangsters, so this right here is Al Capone, a famous, probably the most famous gangster in U.S. history, you know, of Chicago. He was, you know, associated with Chicago gangland slayings and things like that. So you see the old movies like The Untouchables and stuff like that, with these guys who are dressed with the fedora and the, you know, suit and coat and tie, and they go around with Tommy guns and drive, you know, snazzy looking cars, and they're gangsters. Well, they flourished because of alcohol prohibition. Just like today, organized crime specializes in illegal narcotics like cocaine and marijuana and heroin, things like that. Back then, when alcohol was illegal, that was the big money maker. Okay, so, but there's all kinds of downsides to alcohol prohibition, such as gangland violence. More people were dying from alcohol poisoning because for various reasons it was hard to assess the purity. When it's illegal, you have an incentive to get a more potent form of the product. So people who when it was legal would drink beer and wine, when alcohol was illegal, might move into just, you know, straight whiskey or something, because given that you're going to be breaking the law to go buy some alcohol that you got, you know, buy from some guy in a, you know, secret place that you go around behind the restaurant and look around and make sure no cop is looking, you buy it and give them the money and give it to you in a paper bag and you get out of there. Given that you're going to do that kind of stuff and you're risking getting arrested and being publicly humiliated for being a lawbreaker, you're not going to go through all that just to get a bottle of wine, right? Because that's not going to be as much of a buzz for you. It's too risky to have to just keep doing that every time you want to drink. So if instead you get a bottle of whiskey, well, then it makes more sense, right? Because you can get more of an alcohol buzz from a bottle of whiskey than from a bottle of wine or a bottle of beer. All right, so that's just one of the reasons that alcohol prohibition achieved the opposite of what it was intended to in many respects, that it actually didn't get people to not be drunk and to moderate their drinking habits. Actually, for the people who continued drinking, it made them probably worse in that respect. Okay, so anyway, the point of this paper is to say, well, you know, why was it so hard to repeal? Is it in light of the fact that once they had it in place, everybody could see these awful consequences? They could, you know, everybody knew that there were speakeasies where, you know, those were like black market saloons where people would go, you know, they would just hear from their friends or something, oh, on Friday night, if you want to go to a bar, you know, it's this intersection. You got to knock on the door and the password is such and such, and they'll let you in. And then we're all just going to have a party down there. You know, and so it's a bar, and you know, bring your cash, and you get served alcohol, and it's totally illegal. The cops find out about it. You know, we're all going to go to jail, and the cops do know about it, and they don't do anything because they're getting paid off. Right? That was the thing, and that's what people came to realize, is that it was so blatant that so many Americans still wanted to drink alcohol, even though it was technically illegal, that they just did it underground, and it was no longer, you know, it wasn't like somebody who broke the law by drinking alcohol was considered the same as someone who broke the law by murdering someone, right? Just like nowadays, it's illegal to smoke marijuana, but so many people do it that it's not considered to be that socially reprehensible. So same thing back then. So this article, Baptist and Bootlegger, was trying to explore politically why did prohibition remain in force for so long. And it was saying because certain people liked it. And so the obvious example are the Baptists. And they just used that as a proxy for meaning the extremely religious people who wanted alcohol prohibition to remain in force for moral and religious reasons. That they thought, you know, oh, let's get rid of drinking. Drinking is sinful, and people shouldn't be drunk in public, and it's destructive of the family, and that. And so, you know, one of the functions of government is to enforce rules that maintain a healthy society. And so, of course, we're going to outlaw alcohol. Why wouldn't we? So that makes sense. I mean, it's naive and it's ignorant, perhaps, of economics, but that kind of makes sense. Now, what might initially surprise you is why would the bootleggers, so bootlegger means the term for somebody who either creates or distributes, or I should say produces or distributes alcohol when it's illegal. That's what a bootlegger is. They also were in favor of continued prohibition. And that might seem weird to you. The very people who are under danger of going to jail, you would think they would be the ones more than anybody who would want the government to legalize what they're doing. But actually, this article pointed out that no, they weren't. The organized crime figures were in favor of continued alcohol prohibition. And that's because they knew they were the ones, like, in that system, they thrived. Right? So Al Capone, we wouldn't even know who he was. His name wouldn't mean anything to us had alcohol always been legal. He probably would not have been a famous CEO or, you know, some scientist or a sports star or a famous dancer But no, what he was good at was bribing police officers and judges and killing people and running a business when other people in the industry are trying to kill you, and just being a little bit smarter than they were and killing them first, and maintaining an aura of fear so that most people don't mess with you. That's what he was good at. So when alcohol prohibition came along, that gave him a way with those talents that he had, that gave him a way to make a lot of money. Whereas without alcohol prohibition, the ability to anticipate the future better than most other people and be a little bit more ruthless and kill the other guy before he kills you, that's not really very useful in a normal market economy. But when there's a heavily prohibited industry with stiff prison sentences for people who get caught, and remember, it's people who get caught who have not bribed the judges and police and who have, you know, figured out how to game the system so that they remain technically in violation of the law, but such that the government officials would rather them stay free and continue to pay them their bribes than to send them to jail. All right, so that sort of skill set is normally not going to make you famous and rich in an unhampered market economy. Okay, let me give you another quick personal anecdote. It's not about energy per se, but really framed my thinking on this kind of stuff. So this design here, this is the cover of a research report that I did for Pacific Research Institute. So it's called Ending the Revenue Roller Coaster, The Benefits of a 3% Flat Income Tax for California. And you can see the artist here was trying to make it look like it was a ticket stub to ride a roller coaster. That's what that image is supposed to be. And this stuff over here, this was the date that it was, May 20th, 2008. That's what those numbers are. All right, so the point was, in California, they had had very volatile tax receipts. During the boom period, like, you know, 03 to 06, let's say, their revenues were soaring, and so their spending ramped up. And then, you know, once the housing market crashed, imagine several key cities in California were really hit hard by the housing crash, because the real estate values in California had risen a lot. And also, just the booming stock market thing. I mean, it was California, when the economy's booming, California, also like Nevada and a few other key places, really booms along with it. And then when the economy crashes, California crashes harder than Idaho, typically. So if the government is very short-sighted, as California governments tend to be, if when money's just gushing in, they jack up their spending, and then they make commitments, right? So it's not like they just do one-off spending projects. They will raise the level of funding for various programs, that then it's hard to dial them back down if the revenue collapses. And so that's what they were talking about, ending the revenue roller coaster. And the idea was, part of why their revenue was so volatile was they had a very, what was called a progressive, or a more neutral term would be graduated, state income tax. So there were several tax brackets. I think there were like seven. I can't remember now off the top of my head, in California. So this is just at the state level. So you still have to pay your federal income taxes depending on what tax bracket you're in. But on top of that, if you live in California, the state levies its own income tax on you that can be quite high. And it's very graduated, meaning the more you make, the higher the rate, the marginal rate that they apply to, you know, that threshold of your income that's above the cutoff from the previous tax bracket. So the idea was, when there's a boom, like the housing bubble, and people are, let's say, like, income kind of rises above trend, the point is the revenue to the state government goes up even more than proportionally, because now everyone's getting knocked into a higher tax bracket. So, you know, if everybody's income goes up by 10%, the revenue to the California state government goes up by more than 10%, because not only is the tax base that much bigger, but now a lot of people are in higher tax brackets, so they're paying a higher marginal rate on that larger income base. And then, but then vice versa, when the economy shrinks and the income base shrinks, then because of this highly graduated tax structure, it means revenues fall them more than proportionally. So again, it's the volatility in California's revenue stream was more pronounced than the volatility in the underlying economy. So the idea was in this study, we said, hey, and with this study, and this is, you know, Murray Rothbard would not probably have approved of me doing this study, but in any event, I did it. And the point was the mandate, if you will, like when they hired me to do it, they said, look, politically, we can't, obviously, we would like to cut taxes a lot. That would be best of all. But if we're just focusing on tax reform for people to get behind this, you know, because they have a deficit already, we can't reduce revenue. So just, you know, what would the flat income tax rate have to be if we just had one tax bracket? That was the idea. So that's what this was. And so I went through and came up with some modeling assumptions, blah, 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 and said if you just charge 3%, you could get rid of right now this convoluted state income tax code, and just everybody just writes down what their income is and multiplies it by 3%, and boom, that's, you know, the state government. And that, under various assumptions, would bring in the same amount of revenue, and then actually said it would bring in more because the economy would grow faster. But, you know, we didn't want to program that in because then we would get denounced as having rosy scenarios. Okay, so that's what it was, like I said, for good or ill. What I will say is, it's if you want to see the logic behind flat tax proposals, this is pretty good. Like I laid it out pretty carefully and walked through the logic of it step by step, more so than is done in other flat tax analyses. So if you at least want to see where people are coming from when they talk about lowering marginal rates and broadening the base in order to raise a given amount of revenue without distorting the economy as much, I fleshed out that kind of argument in this thing. Okay, so like I say, Rothbard probably wouldn't like me having written this paper, but I did. So this thing's making the rounds in California, and you just figure this is just to educate the public. Oh, let me say something else. Going back to that thing that Wolfram said, you might wonder, you might say, well, wait a minute. If none of the people in power actually believe the minimum wage helps poor people, well, then why are we wasting our time teaching everybody supply and demand charts and giving out economics in one lesson and send, you know, writing letters to the editor and op-eds and doing Mises.org articles every time they raise the minimum wage? Why are we bothering with this education if you're telling us it's not that the people in Washington are ignorant of this basic Econ 101 stuff? And my answer is, we're not trying to educate the people in Washington. We're trying to educate the citizens, because ultimately it's public opinion that determines what the people in Washington can get away with. So just think about it. The people in Washington, they don't get up in front of the cameras and say, oh, we're going to raise the minimum wage because last election cycle, the unions here in my district really helped me win. They campaigned for me and they, you know, organized voter registration and they got people to the ballots and stuff. So they really helped me pull off that victory. So I'm going to give them a payback by making it harder for poor people and unskilled workers to compete with them. If you said that, you'd lose your next election, right? And your bill would probably not pass. So why is it that they have to lie and say this is all about helping? You know what? Even that word lie that I just said, I might come back to this in a minute about do the politicians get up there and consciously lie. I'm not sure that they do. I'll come back to that in a second. But why do they get up there and couch it in the way they do? And I'm saying it's because the public believes that. So the public really is that ignorant. The people in the general public who don't work for labor unions and, you know, aren't, and it's not, or even the people in labor unions might believe it too. I'm saying the leaders probably don't, but I'm saying the general person in the public who is going to hear a senator say, I'm voting for this bill because it helps unskilled workers make a decent wage, and we need to support that kind of hard work in this country, and that's what made this country great. Somebody who says, oh, that's cool, I'm going to vote for that guy. That's the person we're trying to educate. Okay, so same thing here. Now, I thought that this proposal would, you know, it was just supposed to be to get people to think about tax issues and to realize the harm of taxes that it, you know, one of the points in this paper was it's not simply the amount of revenue that the government sucks out of the economy that's the problem. It's the way the government does it, that there's better and worse tax codes. And I was just trying to raise the public's awareness of that kind of consideration. And so that they would realize that sticking it to the rich with high marginal income tax rates was actually a way to make people leave California and that you'd end up with less revenue, that kind of stuff. So I was surprised when a guy came and, you know, someone contacted me from a state representative's office. So it was a guy, he wasn't in Congress in D.C. He was a representative in the California government. So I went, you know, so he was in the California legislature, where if they passed something, you know, the governor of California would decide whether to sign it into law or to veto it and that kind of stuff. So this guy had read my paper and he loved it. And he called me out, and so I flew out there and I go meet with him. And he comes, he shakes my hand and everything, real charismatic guy, bubbling over with energy. And he wasn't like, you know, an airhead. He was sharp and he understood the paper. You know, I mean, I could tell after talking with him for a couple minutes. It wasn't just that he thought, oh yeah, this is something I can sell to my constituents. It was, he really understood the logic of it and thought, oh yeah, this would be good for California. This will help businesses. This will help us retain, you know, people who are considering leaving. We'll get more population inflow. We'll bring in more revenue. We'll expand job growth. Why fair to not be penalizing people just because they make more money? That doesn't seem right, right? So that was the idea. So he was a sharp guy. He knew what he was talking about. I'm getting excited, like, oh, this is great. You know, I'm actually, you know, I'm thinking, oh, I'm making a difference or something, right? And by the end of that meeting, his chief of staff had talked him out of doing anything with it. Because this guy was fairly new, you know, to politics, or at least his position. Maybe he had served in local politics before, I don't remember. But this guy I was talking to, who loved my paper, he was all gung-ho about introducing legislation based on these ideas. You know, so he was saying, you know, we're going to reform this stuff and we'll be consulting with you, Dr. Murphy, to make sure it makes sense and that, that, that. So again, I'm just telling you, but whether or not I should have gone down that path in the first place is an interesting question. But the point is, I was thinking, oh, this is neat. You know, I feel kind of special. Someone's listening to me. I'm not just writing stuff on a blackboard. This is actually going to change the real world politics. And like I say, by the end of it, his chief of staff had talked him out of it. And it wasn't because that guy was a bad guy and he was for higher taxes. No, the guy, he understood the logic of it, but he was saying, look, you're not even going to get this out of committee. If you bring up this bill to replace the current tax code with the 3% flat tax, he said, even other Republicans are not going to support you. That seems way too radical. You're going to get crucified in the press. And then, you know, you might lose your next primary, but for sure you're going to lose your next election. That they're going to, you know, bring this up and say that you hate poor people. Because, you know, part of the way it worked is like you would be getting rid of deductions and exemptions and things that, yes. So in other words, it was conceivable that this proposal would lower existing taxes on certain rich people and raise taxes on people who right now, you know, their tax bill could go up. In other words, they benefited from all sorts of, you know, child tax credits and, you know, all kinds of ways that your income was exempt from the current tax code. Because remember, all that stuff was getting replaced. All the complicated deductions, and it was all just getting removed, and there's everybody, boom, what's your income, pay 3%, end of story. That's what this proposal was about. And so he was just pointing out that you know, no, they're going to go find people whose taxes are going to go up because of this, and then go find some multimillionaire hedge fund manager whose taxes are going to go down and say that's what you support, and you're going to get killed politically. And he, by the end of it, he had convinced the guy that, You know, so in other words, he was saying it won't even make it out of committee because the other Republicans aren't even going to support this. And so he's saying you're not going to benefit, you know, California is not going to benefit from this. There's no way this is going to pass. So it's not going to become law. You're going to get none of the benefits. All that's going to happen if you bring this up is in the next election, they're going to have this big issue that hang around your neck and you're going to have to be defending yourself on this thing. So why would you do that? For no reason whatsoever. And like I said, by the end of it, he convinced the guy. And so by the end of the meeting, okay, thanks, Dr. Murphy. We'll be in touch. And I never heard from the guy again. So that's when I realized, you know, sort of like the scene in the Christmas story when Ralphie walks out wiser, same thing here, that's what had happened where I walked out of there. You know, first of all, once I got out of there, I realized, you know, it's probably good that happened because once you start getting really entwined in the political process, it's hard to remain principled and you start, you know, doing all kinds of stuff. Just like even the very construction of this report. Like I said, technically, there were people in California whose tax bill probably would have gone up because of this thing. So in general, you know, do I favor raising anyone's taxes? Of course not. But it was the kind of thing where, well, gee, I'm a consultant. This think tank hired me. They wanted me to, you know, it was a very free market institution. And we wanted to reform the California tax code to lower rates on people and stuff. But it had to be revenue neutral. That was the precondition. And the only way to make that happen is if, you know, in other words, if you're going to get rid of some of the deductions and stuff and then choose the magic number, the marginal rate, such that the same amount of revenue comes in, well, then it's unavoidable mathematically. Somebody's tax bill has to go up if you're doing it that way. And so, you know, that's, you see, once you start going down that path and worrying about what's politically feasible, then you start having to defend stuff that actually you don't really believe in. So anyway, point is, that was when I realized that, oh, this is why politics doesn't work. That even if you do find somebody in the political process who's smart and actually agrees with the logic of it, the system really is rigged against that. And so that's why, like, you know, people with the Tea Party and stuff, and when I see people on Facebook getting all fired up about the latest guy who's going to go into Washington, oh man, this guy's hardcore and he's going to get it. And I just, no, he's not. And it's not because he's a bad guy. It's because he's going to get there and realize nothing will happen. I mean, you could say, what about Ron Paul? And right, how did Ron Paul achieve fame and stuff? He always voted no against stuff. So think about it. You know, he was very often the one dissenter on some proposal. And so, yeah, that's cool. And it's good if his point is to just be an example and to educate people and to get their attention. But in terms of changing policy, he's not changing policy by being the one guy who votes for something and 400 plus other people vote the other way. You see what I'm saying? So, yeah, if you want to run for office or whatever in order to gain national recognition so then you can teach people something, okay. But this idea that, oh, man, if we just work really hard and get the right people in there, they're going to vote and change this thing around, I don't think that's going to happen. Okay, I'm going to start moving through these slides pretty quickly now because it took me a lot longer to tell my personal anecdotes than I thought it was going to. Last thing here in terms of just thinking about the logic of government behavior. So I used to, like with Waco, for example, I think a lot of people believe that what happened is they went in there and, yeah, they were overly aggressive, the BATF and the DEA and all these guys that went in there after the fact. And they made a mistake and, oh, man, they ended up setting the place on fire and killing all those people. And, man, isn't that ironic that the ostensible reason for going in there was to rescue those kids from child abuse and they ended up burning them to death? Huh, that's incompetent government for you. And I think that's naive. Now, I can't prove this. I wasn't behind closed doors when the decisions were made. But, you know, if you just think about like a gang, for example, how does a gang stay tough? It's because they scare people. They make it so that, you know, the gang does not want to have to fight somebody every day. The gang just wants it to be known that they're really ruthless and you don't mess with them. And that's why when they show up at your door and say, hey, you owe us protection money, you just pay it. And you don't try to fight back. You don't look and see, well, how many guys are out there on the sidewalk? Are they armed? How many guns do I have? If I kill these guys, would they send more? You don't want people even thinking like that. You just want them to know you don't mess with these guys because they're more ruthless than you are. You just pay them, right? That's what the gang wants you to think. So that's why if somebody ever does, because he's drunk or just nuts or whatever, or he's starting a gang of his own and wants to make a name for himself, if someone ever does stand up to the existing gang that sort of, you know, controls a certain neighborhood or something, the gang can't screw around. They have to just hit back with outrageous force to let it be known, to be an example, to say, you don't mess with it. Because so then if somebody says later, well, how come nobody ever stands up to them, that somebody in the know will say, well, yeah, because 3 years ago, John Miller said he wasn't going to pay them. They, you know, cut all of his fingers off and boiled him in acid. And then, you know, left him there for his wife to find the next morning. That's why we don't mess with those guys. You see what I'm saying? That's the kind of thing that gangs typically do. And when I explain it as just a regular criminal gang doing it, the logic is straightforward and everyone understands that. Nobody would argue with me and say, oh, come on, that's a conspiracy theory. I don't think gang members are really that evil, Bob. Come on. People don't talk to them. Oh, yeah, duh. Of course that's how gangs operate. Okay, so now entertain the hypothesis that governments are aware of those sorts of considerations, and that in some respects, not all respects, but in some respects, governments are the strongest gang in a geographical region. And so even the actual, you know, normal street level gangs don't mess with the cops, and they certainly don't mess with the army. And so if you think like that, then you can say, okay, so the rare occasion when somebody really does stand up to them and shows the public that, well, no, just because they're from the government doesn't mean they're Kryptonians, they have superpowers, and if they show up to a fight and they don't have enough arms, you can repel them. Well, the government can't just let that go. It's got to show, no, 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 you don't do that to us, because if you do, you'll be sorry. And so I don't know if you know, if some don't know this, but with Waco, the prelude to that standoff was that it was either the DEA or the BATF, and I can't remember which one, but some, you know, small group, like a handful of agents from a federal bureau or agency, went up to their compound, and it's unclear exactly what happened, but gunfire was exchanged, and the government people retreated, right? So in other words, the Branch Davidians were more heavily armed, and the small group of people from the federal government that showed up on their property had to run away, because they were getting shot at and realized, whoa, we're outgunned. We better get out of here. We're going to die. And so what I'm saying is, do you think the federal government wants that to happen? And so, again, I don't know. I can't prove what happened, but it wouldn't surprise me if they said that, well, this is what happens to you. And the same thing with Fallujah. If you know the story about that, we got to move on here. We don't have much time. But this was, you know, when there was these military contractors that were working for the United States government in Iraq, and somehow they got captured, and the local population, it's not just that they killed them, but they like desecrated the bodies and like dragged them through the street and stuff. And it was a very, you know, embarrassing thing, like to say to the West, we're standing up to you just because you have smart bombs and more tanks and stuff. Don't think you're invincible. We can still hurt you. And so if you read about what happened in Fallujah, and you read about, you know, people who are blogging and whatever from inside that city when the siege was occurring, they were saying the U.S. government and the other allied forces were doing all kinds of stuff, like, you know, shooting people, shooting insurgents or whatever, and then when the emergency personnel would show up, shooting them too. And when you first hear that, you're like, oh, come on, why would you know, Western troops be shooting people driving an ambulance? There must have been an accident. They wouldn't Again, I don't know. I wasn't there when the orders were handed on down, but it's conceivable they would do that for the same reason that a gang would, that to show, no, 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 yeah, you can be in a war with us and so on, but if you do something really, you know, embarrassing to us, like dragging bodies around and stuff and, with, you know, saying death to the USA, well, you better know that your whole city is going to suffer for that. And so maybe in the future, people will think twice before they do something like that. Okay, so anyway, I'm just saying those two events were also, you know, in part of my own evolution about thinking, just modeling how is it the people in the government operate. So I guess what I'm saying is, if you would be perfectly prepared to believe that a normal street level gang would operate in a certain way because they realize that's how they maintain their power, then it's kind of inconsistent if you say, oh, but the people who run major world governments, who wage wars that kill millions of people, that they would be unwilling to do that kind of thing, because that just would prick their consciences. That's what I'm saying, is don't think that. That doesn't make any sense. Okay, one last thing here on the preliminaries. Another thing that influenced my thinking and rang true with me was, this is a comedy, this movie Burn After Reading. You might be surprised if you see, like, what are you talking about? It's a, you know, goofy movie. Brad Pitt plays a really funny character, George Clooney and so on. But this guy, who is like a mid-level bureaucrat in the CIA, his character to me really is just very close, I think, to how these people operate. So it's not this character, he's not malicious. It's not that he goes and enjoys inflicting pain and suffering on innocent people for no good reason. That's not what motivates him. What he wants to do is to make sure that there's no scandal. And he has no conscience, right? So it's kind of like, you know, a normal person doesn't go out of their way to go find cockroaches and kill them. It's not like someone that normal people get joy out of finding cockroaches and killing them. But normal people, if they find cockroaches in their house, they're going to kill them and get rid of them. And so that's what this guy was with regard to human beings. That it's not that he derived pleasure from inflicting pain and killing other people, but if somebody was messing with his operation and there was any way his career was going to be jeopardized by it, he had no compunction about killing somebody or if somebody died. Okay, so I think that's a pretty good model of how a lot of these people operate in the government. Okay, let's just talk a little bit about big oil. Like I say, I'm pretty far behind here, so I'm going to go through some of these slides quickly. This issue about tax breaks, you hear this all the time, tax breaks for big oil. So let me just run through some things. So first of all, a lot of them are actually don't apply to the integrated majors. They only apply to the independent oil companies. Okay, so President Obama a few years ago, you know, he had one of his proposals for reforming the tax code, and a couple of the key provisions we're going to do, like, alter the rules on, I'm trying to remember the exact terminology. Well, part of it was for this manufacturing deduction, and another thing was on was called intangible drilling costs. And another thing was called a depletion allowance, all right? And so this tax reform was, and Obama talked about it in one of his Rose Garden speeches or something, and he was saying how they were going to get rid of this stuff and take away the tax breaks for big oil because we've been subsidizing them too long. They're hurting the environment. And like I said, there was a lot of stuff that was wrong with what he was saying. But one of the things was these measures, or at least two of them, were not eligible for the international integrated major oil companies. You know, all they were is for smaller, what were called independent oil companies. The only ones were even eligible to apply for some of these things. So right off the bat, it's wrong to say this was tax breaks for big oil. The other thing was, it was wrong to call it a tax break, or at least it was more nuanced. So, you know, these things, well, the depletion allowance in particular, that what that's talking about is, as you're, you know, you own a deposit of oil sitting under the ground, let's say. And if you think about it, you know, if you drain a barrel of that and sell it for $85 in the open market, is that really $85 in net income to you? Well, no, because you've reduced your inventories. That's just gross revenue. But you had, you know, the market value now of your capital asset, this pool of oil sitting under the ground, that has gone down because you just drained one barrel of oil from it. Just like if you're a retailer and you have a bunch of sweaters that sell for retail for $85, you got a bunch of sweaters in your warehouse and you sell one of them, the $85 you earn there is not pure net income because now your inventory just went down. You see what I'm saying? So the depletion allowance takes that into account somewhat, and so you get to, as an oil company, you get to lower your net income by taking account of the fact that you're depleting your oil reserves. And so that's kind of just like depreciation on fixed machinery or something. So that's hardly a tax break. That's just accounting. And then this manufacturing is similar thing with intangible drilling costs. That's a little more esoteric. Let's skip that. But this manufacturing deduction, now that legitimately could be construed as a tax break. But the irony here was, you know, this was introduced by the Bush administration. I forget what year. And it was applicable for all U.S. companies that could claim they were creating manufacturing jobs domestically. And the idea was we're going to give them a tax break to encourage domestic manufacturing. So whether you think that's a good policy or not, the point is the Obama administration came along and said, we're going to make the tax code fair and take away these unfair advantages. And so they were going to change the legislation to say any U.S. company that creates manufacturing jobs in the, you know, the Gulf region or whatever the heck it was, except if you're an oil company. And that was the way they were going to make the tax code, you know, more even-handed and level the playing field. They didn't get rid of this whole deduction for manufacturing. They just took this existing deduction and then said, oh, but this doesn't apply to you if you're an oil company. So, I mean, it made the tax code even more particular and less, you know, just a general set of rules that apply to everyone uniformly. So I'm just, again, showing you the way this stuff plays out. It's hilarious when you learn the detail. Okay, let me tell you a quick story. Exxon Valdez spill. So this happened off the coast of Alaska. This was a big deal when I was growing up. You know, the captain got drunk and, you know, it was a horrible oil spill and all kinds of creatures were covered with oil and everything. It was just, you know, public relations disaster, and Exxon ended up with this huge settlement. So I was talking to this guy, and unfortunately, I can't find this story online, right? So all I can tell you, all I can do is repeat my rough recollection of what this guy told me. So I believe the guy, but I'm just saying I can't get the exact detail of it to give you guys an article on. But he was telling me that, so think about it. So they're, in order to give the judgment against Exxon, because, you know, their oil tanker, you know, hit something and then started leaking and all this oil washes up on the beaches and they clean up. And so one component of the damages was they had to figure out how many, you know, birds and other kinds of, you know, sea creatures and stuff died as a result of this oil spill. And so at first they were just saying, well, let's just go up on the beach and count, you know, all the birds that are covered in oil. And if any dead stuff washes up, yeah, I don't remember what kind of fish they were looking for, but, you know, things that were swimming around that were near the surface and maybe they get covered in oil and then they wash up on the beach. So clearly they died because of this oil spill. But they said, well, wait a minute, but that's undercounting the deaths, right? Because there's all kinds of birds and other stuff that are out on the ocean that died because of the oil spill, but they didn't wash up on the beach, so we can't see them. So we need to figure out a way to understand what ratio of a creature that's out in the ocean that gets hit with the oil spill then washes up on the beach for us to observe. And then once we know that ratio, we can see how many are sitting here on the beach and then, you know, multiply and figure out come up with an estimate of the total damage to wildlife is so that we can appropriately find Exxon. So the way they did that is, you said they took a bunch of animals, and I forget what they were. I mean, I want to say they were like, you know, elk or something, you know, some beautiful creature that people publicly love. I can't remember what they were. So they get a bunch of, this is from the government, they get a bunch of these creatures and they shoot them and kill them, and then they coat them in oil, and then they take them in a net and a helicopter and fly out, you know, to like where the oil tanker was, and then, oh, and they put like radio trackers on their necks and then drop them in the water. And then they observe how many of that wash up on the beach. And so then we know, okay, what proportion of the ones we ourselves killed and covered in oil and then dropped in the water, what proportion of those washed up on the beach? And so that's not how we can come up with a ratio to apply to Exxon. So anyway, for whatever reason, I thought that story was hilarious. Okay, let's see. Pro-carbon tax. So here, again, we're talking about big oil companies. There are large oil companies, not going to name names, who would be are for a modest carbon tax, which makes it all the more ironic that, you know, the recent Senate testimony, the proponents of more government intervention were saying big oil companies were probably funding the people like me who were there trying to say, wait a minute, let's look through the logic here and make sure the analysis makes sense, when actually there are plenty of large oil companies who are for a carbon tax. Now, why would they be for a carbon tax? It's not because they have a sudden change of heart and care about their grandchildren now, whereas, you know, 5 years ago, they didn't care if their grandchildren were underwater because of global warming. That's not the issue. What happened is many of them ran their businesses and, you know, made investments and so forth under the expectation that there would be a modest carbon tax put in place eventually in the United States. So, for example, you know, buying a natural gas interest in sort of in shifting out of coal. And so if there's a modest carbon tax put in place, that's not going to make the whole country all of a sudden run on wind power and geothermal, because they're too inefficient right now. It wouldn't work. What would happen is if there's a modest carbon tax put in place, coal-fired power plants would go out of business and natural gas would capture a huge share of the market for electricity production. And then possibly also it would accelerate, you know, using natural gas buses, city buses and stuff like that instead of using gasoline. And the reason is that natural gas has a lower carbon content than coal does. And so once certain large oil companies or energy companies, let's say, have made those investments that way, now if there isn't a carbon tax, they're going to lose out relative to the situation in which there is a carbon tax. So another way of putting it is a carbon tax that's modest will knock out their competitors and they'll still be on top. Just like a lot of large companies are for, Sarbanes-Oxley and those kind of regulations that impose a lot of requirements you need to have all kinds of accountants on staff full time just complying with the new regulations. If you're a big Fortune 500 company, you can afford to absorb that overhead a lot more easily than some upstart competitor that's only got 10 employees. And so these large established companies very often embrace allegedly anti-business regulation because, yeah, it hurts them, but it hurts their competitors more. Okay, this drill, baby drill, this was a funny thing. It was the Mineral Management Service, the MMS. They got in such trouble, they had such scandals, they actually had to change their name. They were a government reorganization. And they're now, the acronym is BOEMREO, or no, BEM, yeah, I think it's just BEMREO. So I'm like BEMRA, it doesn't even spell a word anymore. It's like the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management Regulation and Enforcement is what it stands for. But anyway, there were these two huge scandals that happened pretty close together. So one of them was they were supposed to be regulating, I think it was like in Louisiana or something, like, you know, gas and oil companies in that area, like offshore and that sort of thing. And they got caught. It was ridiculous. Like they were allowing representatives from the oil and gas companies throw parties for these regulators in the MMS where they were bringing in prostitutes and having cocaine and stuff like that. Parties thrown by the people they're supposed to be regulating. And then the drill, baby drill, was in Alaska that there was the MMS agency where they were overseeing, you know, the Alaskan oil companies. They had a party and on the cake was written drill, baby drill. I don't know if this is an actual picture of the cake or just a, you know, after the fact, but it's the guy apologized. You know, the head of that MMS office, you know, sent an email to his superiors in Washington apologized and saying, yeah, I realize in retrospect this is not a funny joke and da da da. But the point is, when people run to the government to crack down on big oil and to keep us safe from them, I mean, it's just hilarious. They get co-opted by it, and it's, anyway. Okay, some thoughts about the environmentalist movement. If you were really convinced about climate change, man-made climate change, and you thought that we had to totally stop CO2 emissions very quickly or drastically reduce CO2 emissions lest the Earth reach an unstoppable tipping point in terms of climate change, you would be a very big proponent of nuclear power. Because that, given how people are accustomed to their current lifestyle and how you can just see politically, it's not going to work to impose a very large carbon tax or, cap and trade or whatever other kind of direct measures to drastically reduce CO2 emissions that way through curtailing energy consumption. What your fallback would be is to say, okay, realistically, given that we keep telling the public we've got like a 5-year window before it's too late, before we pass that tipping point, in terms of, we've already emitted so much that now even if we drastically cut back, it's too late. You would then campaign for huge expansions in nuclear power because that actually might work. You actually could replace a lot of coal-fired plants with nuclear plants and natural gas and so forth, and that might work. Whereas you can't just do it with wind turbines and geothermal and that kind of thing. That just won't work. Just right now. I mean, maybe 50 years from now it will work. But right now, if you needed to have a drastic reduction in CO2 emissions without reducing electricity consumption, you would have to go nuclear. But yet, the environmentalists are opposed to nuclear also. The same people who are so strident and vocal about, oh my gosh, we got to really cut back on CO2 emissions or our grandkids are going to be underwater. Those people are also, no, we can't have more nuclear power plants because there's radioactive waste and blah, 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 blah. And so it makes me think that really for a lot of these acts, I'm not talking about the general public who says, oh yeah, let's try to recycle more. Okay. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about like the hardcore activists whose, lives are devoted to changing energy policy. I'm saying I don't think they're motivated purely by an intellectual concern over climate change. I think it's more they don't like large levels of energy consumption, that offends their moral sensibilities. Another example of this is there's what's called renewable portfolio standards. So at the state level, certain states have requirements saying this percentage of our electricity has to come from renewables, renewable sources. And so what's interesting is in states, and there's this general pattern. I don't know if this is true in every case, but at one point, for sure, looking at these renewable standards and the way they were structured, what counted as renewable differed from state to state. And if you went somewhere in the middle, a landlocked region in the middle of the country that had no hydropower, hydro would count as renewable. But if you went to a state that actually was, near waterfalls or something, or where hydropower actually could provide a significant portion of electricity, hydro didn't count as renewable. It had to be something, like geothermal or wind power to satisfy this constraint, of that you need X percent of your electricity to be generated by renewable sources. And so, again, this is another example where I think the people pushing for these regulations, a lot of them, again, the hardcore activists, if something is profitable, they don't like it. It must not be right. That the only reason way something can be good is if the market wouldn't produce it and government needs to force it, because otherwise it's intrinsically dirty. Okay, another example, the government has to ignore its rules for killing certain birds when it comes to wind turbines. And with that limited time, if you wanted to go Google this, type in something like wind turbines, dead birds or something, you'll probably find some funny stories about it. And so the idea is if you go to the base of these wind turbines, there's all kinds of dead birds all the time. That's a big issue if you think about it. There's huge things spinning through the air. And they're also, the sound they make up, I guess, the birds don't pick up on that. So, and like I say, if you had some other kind of, there's cases where, if it were some other kind of project you know, somebody were building a skyscraper or something and it was killing these certain types of birds, that the government would come in and shut you down. But because it's politically favored renewable wind power, they turn a blind eye to it. Okay, lots of stuff with ethanol. I'll be really fast. So ethanol for a while was a darling of the environmentalists because the idea was, oh, it's allowing us to power automobiles without relying on oil. Because now instead of refining gasoline out of oil, we'll use it with ethanol. And so the problem is they started to realize after a while that, well, no, actually, there's lots of problems that it means that it raises food prices. So now, for example, corn is being diverted into people's cars rather than into people's bellies. And so there are lots of studies suggesting, well, gee, maybe that's one of the reasons for high food prices. And then also, when you look at the whole life cycle involved, it's not clear that it actually reduces CO2 emissions. When you look at the whole, you know, like I said, the whole process of getting from the resource to the tank, it's not obvious. And so environmentalists even have come around on this particular thing. But as far as the government policy, there was a mandate on refiners that they had to have a certain percentage consist of ethanol, and then there was also a tax subsidy, you know, meaning so that there was a tax advantage given to people, refiners used it, and then there was also a tariff. And so it's these last two that are interesting. So the government was trying to give a financial incentive to refiners if they blended ethanol into their mix as opposed to just doing conventional gasoline. But they wanted it to benefit American farmers. They wanted, in other words, these refiners to take advantage of the tax subsidy for blending in ethanol by buying corn-based ethanol from U.S. farmers. That was the point politically, to do something good for the farm lobby so that, you know, farmers are very powerful politically. But in Brazil, they can produce sugarcane ethanol more cheaply than the Americans can produce corn-based ethanol. And so they realized, oh, wait a minute, if we just get the subsidy, you know, and I'm just using the word subsidy because I can't remember if it was a deduction or a credit. That's why I'm using the word. Some people object to using the term subsidy, but I'm explaining why I'm doing that. They were afraid that, wait a minute, and I've even found a quote from some congressman saying this explicitly. He said, well, if we just let in the Brazilian sugar-based ethanol, well, then, you know, we would have this tax, I think it's a credit, that would benefit Brazilians and not benefit U.S. farmers. And so that's what we're going to put in a tariff. So they put in a tariff that was a little bit steeper than the tax credit. Again, I think it was a credit. I can't remember. I'm pretty sure it was a credit, as opposed to like a deduction. Okay, so you see how that works? So again, if all the concern was helping the environment by encouraging people to get ethanol instead of just using straight conventional gasoline, you would think, well, we can use Brazilian ethanol or we can use US-based ethanol. What's different? But it's because, no, the political program was to get money flowing to American farmers so that they would vote for the politicians who were in favor of that, or they would donate to their campaign or whatever. It was not about helping the environment. And so that's why they put in a tariff to keep out the Brazilian-made ethanol. Okay, some remarks on my testimony. And I'm seeing if you guys have any Q&A here. Okay, yeah. Unfortunately, as you can see, I'm not going to have time for Q&A. I'll just go through the end of this and then catch you guys in the office hours. Okay. This stuff is all prepared beforehand. When you go and testify, like, okay, so when I go and test, the people who call their witnesses, like, they know beforehand what questions are going to be asked. So it's not like you get up there and it's just a, whoa, I wasn't expecting that. Now, you don't know, like, if it's a hostile senator, you don't know what they're going to say to you, but in terms of, you know, you kind of have a sense of the friendly questions, what they're going to be, and, you know, and they kind of know what your answer, you know, so it's kind of like in a courtroom, you know, when the standard rule of thumb is don't ask a question that you don't know what the answer is. So the same kind of thing. So it's you know, pretty much a big show that's put out. Let me just say some brief remarks, as I've testified a few times in front of Barney Frank and Dennis Kucinich and Barbara Boxer. So people are surprised when I say, but Barney Frank is a really charming guy. I thought he was awesome. I mean, I obviously don't like his politics. I don't, you know, if you wrote out his biography, I'm sure I would disagree with a lot of what he's done in his life. I'm just saying, when I was sitting there in a room with him and he was up there, I wanted him to like me. Just let you know, all right? And people are saying, I'm just saying he was a charming guy, and I'm trying to put my finger on it. It was because he was kind of polite, and he kept apologizing to us because they had to keep running in and out because, you know, they had a floor vote or something. You know what I mean? So they were having the testimony, the panel, the committee's panel, where we were the experts sitting there at the table and, reading our remarks, and then they were asking us questions. But the people who were sitting there, the politicians, had to keep leaving the room because there were all these votes that were happening down the hall. And so we were sitting at a table for a lot longer than we should have been. And like I say, he kept apologizing, and it was sincere. You know what I mean? And I can't, you know, explain to you, but it really came across that we'll be right back. Whereas in contrast, you know, Barbara Boxer certainly was not trying to make me feel comfortable, quite the opposite. All right, now, it could be just the politics were different, and maybe in a different situation, you know, Barney Frank would be biting the head off or something. I don't know. I'm just saying what happened when we were sitting there, the times I was there. And then if you saw that YouTube clip that I linked to in the ad for this course, the one funny thing was Dennis Kucinich at one point was, for some reason, because I was there testifying, explaining that I thought the Federal Reserve had a lot to do with high oil prices. And for some reason, he misunderstood me, and because I think he just assumed, oh, I was some right winger and that I was for the bailouts or whatever. And so he was kind of saying, you know, because obviously, as you know, with his relationship with Ron Paul, Kucinich, even though he's like a leftist, is also cynical of the Federal Reserve, but more because he doesn't like, you know, them helping rich people and things like that. So he kind of asked me something a little bit, like thinking he was outmaneuvering me, that he was being more cynical and radical, and that I wasn't seeing the forest for the trees. And I kind of just prodded him more to say, well, yeah, I like what you're saying, but take it further. You know, why do we need to have a central bank or something like that? But I don't even think he was listening to me. That's what I'm saying with these things. The point, when these people ask you questions, they don't care what your answer is. They're not there to learn. They're there so that the camera sees them asking the question, so that, you know, the people who support them can say, oh, yeah, so, you know, this guy was sticking it to that bald right winger who probably likes the bailouts. You know what I mean? So it was not that I had any misconception that I was educating Dennis Kucinich. Okay, and the last thing I'll say, and then I'll let you guys go here, and we'll wrap up this course, is the timing of these things. So, and I'm trying to be balanced here and give it from both sides. So if you're somebody who thinks like me and doesn't want the government to be intervening in energy markets, and if you want the federal government to get out of the way and let energy companies develop natural gas and crude oil reserves that are on federal lands right now, it's really good TV and politics to have those kind of hearings when oil prices and gas prices are real high. Right, if gasoline's $4.50 a gallon, Americans are going to be a lot more receptive to some politician who's, you know, introducing a bill to open up Alaska to drilling. Whereas if gasoline prices are real low, then people don't care as much. And similarly, if you are going to have a hearing on climate change and how, oh my gosh, all these CO2 emissions are making the earth hotter, when are you going to have that? When was this hearing that we just had? It was in the middle of July when it was ridiculously hot in Washington. We're all sweating like crazy just walking to the building. They don't have a hearing like that in February. And I don't think that's a coincidence. That, because if you had it in the dead of winter, it wouldn't seem like such an issue. Whereas you're holding a hearing on climate change and global warming, and we really need to do something before our grandkids melt, it's better to do that when it's blistering hot in the summer. All right. So, again, just people think of stuff like that once you get to be in Washington. That's the kind of stuff they worry about. They don't worry so much about, you know, the academic arguments pro and con. Okay, so last thing, I had mentioned earlier that I would talk a little bit about, you know, are these people lying? And it's kind of like, I honestly don't think they even view it as that anymore. And it's hard to explain it unless you've seen it, but you're looking at a bunker mentality. And you're in Washington. And like I said, I just know this just because, you know, I work with certain groups there. And so I fly up there and talk to you, and it's, you know, you're very paranoid and you're very concerned about what the other side's going to do to you because they really are ruthless. You know, like for our issues and working on energy issues and stuff, the so-called progressives, the leftists who write about this, I mean, they will not even think twice about writing a hit piece on you and accusing you of all sorts of awful stuff. Just the vocabulary they use. They talk about, you know, dirty energy instead of just calling it, you know, coal-fired power plants or whatever. They call it dirty energy. So, I mean, just think about the mentality of someone who talks like that as opposed to being more specific about when you're loading the deck and making it emotional from the get-go. And so that's what I'm saying, that, you know, when you're dealing with stuff like that, it makes you get real defensive and stuff. And so, like, the people who are actually politicians or whatever, actually, even if you go into there originally with the purest of motives and stuff, I mean, it would be hard for you to abide by the normal rules of civilized discourse when your opponents are routinely lying through their teeth. And so when you grow up in a culture like that, and you've been there for 30 years, I think after a while you just get used to it, and you just kind of, you know, when you get up, you know, like when there's some kind of scandal that breaks or something, and you get up there and you do damage control in front of the media, and a normal person might say, oh, but wait a minute, you're saying something that you know isn't true. Isn't that a lie? And I think, you know, these politicians or their spokespeople or whatever, I mean, they just, like, think of it this way. The official spokesperson for the White House, in one sense, he lies for, or she lies for a living. But I don't think, I mean, I think part of the way they justify that is that they say, well, no, everyone knows the position I'm in. And so they know when I say such and such that really what I mean is thus and so. You get what I'm saying? So I think that, you know, in a certain level, they don't think they're lying. Let me give you one last thing here and then I'll let you guys go. Obama has what I think is a tell. A lot of times, I don't know if he said it lately, partly because I hadn't been listening to him lately, but when he was first, you know, elected and was the new president, and I was watching his speeches and stuff, and he'd be getting interviewed, a lot of times, you know, somebody would ask him something, and he would say, he would preface it by saying, as I've always said, and then he'd go on and state what his official position was on something. And so I think a lot of, you know, it comes off as if he's just, you know, answering the question, like, you know, President Obama, what's your position on coal-fired power plants? Isn't it true that you want to bankrupt them? And then he might say, well, as I've always said, it's such and so, or maybe even as I've said before or something, or as I've often said, something like that. Maybe he doesn't say always. But the point is, it makes it sound like he's just explaining this is his consistent thing and he's not changing his mind. But it occurred to me one time that maybe what he's doing right there is he knows that what he's going to say is a lie. But to make it not a lie, he prefaced it and said, this is what I said to you last Tuesday. You get what I'm saying? It's like if somebody said that, you know, if somebody said, hey, what's your name? And I'm going to say it's, you know, Frank Jones, which is a lie. But what if I say, well, as I've said before, my name is Frank Jones. Technically, I didn't just lie. Right. if I had to, so all you have to do is lie that first time and say it. And then from that point onward, you just answer the question by saying, well, as I've said before, such and such. And so, again, I can't prove this is wild speculation on my part, but it occurred to me that maybe partly why he does that is so he doesn't have the natural physiological reactions from when you're lying. And so he can say something truthful but without it being lied. Just to give you one last example, Rush Limbaugh had a thing about Bill Clinton, and again, who knows what's true, but he speculated, you know, Bill Clinton's famous biggest lie is that he said, you know, at his press conference with the Monica Lewinsky scandal, and Clinton was real impassioned and says, let me be clear, I did not have sexual relations with that woman, Miss Lewinsky, or something like that. And so, you know, Rush Limbaugh was saying, no, he wasn't lying. He was saying, you know, I have not had sexual relations with that woman. He was picturing like his Aunt Myrtle and then comma Miss Lewinsky. So in Clinton's mind, he was addressing that declarative statement to Monica Lewinsky. He was just telling her a fact that he hadn't had sex with that woman, and the woman he had in his mind was some woman that he really hadn't had sex with. So anyway, again, I'm just trying to be cutesy here with you guys, but my point is, I think that, you know, at a certain level, when these people play games with each other, and you're just in a city surrounded by professional liars, like after a while, it turns into a game, and I think there's all kinds of psychological defense mechanisms and tricks that they do, so that a lot of times they're actually not even lying, even though what they're doing is incredibly misleading. And then a normal person would say, oh, he's lying. I bet in their mind they're actually not, because it's kind of hard to go through life thinking you're evil. And so I'm thinking a lot of them just come up with ways to do it such that in their mind, no, I'm not a bad person. I'm doing a good thing here. So take that for what you will. Okay, guys, thanks for taking the course. I hope you learned some stuff, and I will post your quiz if you're taking this for credit, and then the final exam that covers the entire course, and I'll post the office hour information. All right, guys, talk to you later.